It's good to see everybody out this morning. We're in Daniel chapter 2 today, towards the end of the chapter. We're going to be continuing on in our study of Daniel. Last week we almost got through chapter 2, but I wasn't really expecting us to get all the way through it, so that worked out well. And I think where we stopped was right around verse 44. And just as a quick recap, this is the sort of the first prophetic chapter in the book of Daniel, where Daniel has been given the opportunity to interpret a dream for King Nebuchadnezzar. And last week we read through that story. We talked about how Daniel responded to the situation in the kingdom where all of the wise men and the conjurers and the magicians, the Chaldeans, were being threatened with execution because they couldn't tell Nebuchadnezzar what his dream was. The king was wise enough to say, "I want you to tell me what I actually dreamed, not just what you think it means." And we read about how Daniel used discretion and discernment. He spoke to the captain who was in charge of carrying out those orders. He was able to get an audience with King Nebuchadnezzar. And he was able to tell the king not only what he dreamed, but also the interpretation of it. And we talked about the statue that's on the board, what each component of this statue stands for. They're all symbols, right? They're all symbols for different kingdoms. And we talked about how this prophecy is a little different than some of the other prophecies you might study in the Bible, and what was the key difference that we talked about. How does it help us? How is it easier for us to study this prophecy than it is other prophecies? Well, we're given the identity right off the bat of some of these symbols. We're told by Daniel that the head of gold represents the current kingdom, the kingdom of Babylon. And then through knowledge of history, which we have in abundance, we can identify the rest of these symbols pretty easily. So what I would say is what's different about this prophecy is that we've been given more than enough information to solve each of these symbols and find out with a fair amount of certainty what they represent. So we've got Babylon, the kingdom of Medo-Persia, the kingdom of Greece, and lastly, the kingdom of Rome. And I talked about how the verses 40 through 43 that talk about this fourth kingdom, to me, are as easy to interpret as Isaiah 53. When you read Isaiah 53, there's no question who that's talking about, the suffering servant. It's a very specific, detailed portrait of Christ. And when you read these verses, knowing what we know about the Roman Empire that's come and gone, we can be pretty certain that that's who he's talking about. This is a portrait of Rome. So we know who these different symbols stand for, and we stopped just short of talking about the final kingdom that's described in this dream. Continuing in verse 44, Daniel says, "In the days of those kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom which will never be destroyed." Those kings referring to what was just described in the previous four verses. Those kings meaning Rome. All of the rulers that come through the Roman Empire. "And that kingdom will not be left for another people. It will crush and put an end to all these kingdoms, but it will itself endure forever. Inasmuch as you saw that a stone was cut out of the mountain without hands, and that it crushed the iron, the bronze, the clay, the silver, and the gold, the great God has made known to the king what will take place in the future. So the dream is true, and its interpretation is trustworthy." So which kingdom do you think is symbolized by this stone that is cut out without hands and hurled at the statue? The kingdom of God. And when does that kingdom come? It's already come. Right. When?
Well, the real manifestation of it was the first Pentecost after Jesus' resurrection.
Okay. Yeah, first Pentecost after Jesus' resurrection. If you think back to the Acts class, we talked about how that's generally considered to be in Scripture the beginning of the church. So that's who we're talking about. The stone that was made without hands is the kingdom of God. and it's brought on by Jesus Christ. Now, at the time, it's not really clear how much of that Daniel was aware of. We don't know how clear, how complete Daniel's picture of Jesus might have been. But it's clear that God's revealed to Daniel that I'm going to come with power, and I'm going to establish a kingdom that is going to decimate all of these others. And what are some other qualities that you see in these verses I just read about this other kingdom that's going to come? It'll have no end. It's an eternal kingdom. What else? Sure, it'll prevail over all other kingdoms. And there's a key component to it that makes it different than these other four kingdoms up on the board. Other than the fact that it'll be eternal, these kingdoms are all finite. But there's another key component to it that makes it different. It's not made with human hands. It's not put together by the power and the ambition of men. It's the kingdom of God. It's made without human hands. And that's the symbology in that part of the dream where the rock is fashioned of its own. I would also say that it's obscure and humble. This rock that comes from a mountain that blended into the mountain before it was made. It comes from humble beginnings, right? Just like Jesus did. But through that humility and through that obscurity, God creates a kingdom that is eternal and made without human power. And it's going to crush all others. And so as we finish out this chapter, in verse 46, then King Nebuchadnezzar fell on his face and did homage to Daniel and gave orders to present to him an offering and fragrant incense. The king answered Daniel and said, "Surely your God is a God of gods and a Lord of kings and a revealer of mysteries, since you have been able to reveal this mystery." Then the king promoted Daniel and gave him many great gifts, and he made him ruler over the whole province of Babylon and chief prefect over all the wise men of Babylon. And Daniel made request of the king, and he appointed Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego over the administration of the province of Babylon while Daniel was at the king's court. So Nebuchadnezzar confirms the accuracy of Daniel's telling of this dream. And he's promoted, and he then promotes his three friends. I think we see several lessons in this chapter. I've talked a lot about the character of Daniel, and that certainly pops up here as well. Again, he puts his trust in God, just like he did in chapter 1. We see the incredible trust and faith that Daniel has in his God in the most dire of circumstances. He's being threatened with death, along with so many other men like him in the kingdom. And it helped him to face that challenge. And again, he gave thanks. He always gives thanks. In fact, last week we talked about the order that these things happen in. And we noticed that the very first thing Daniel did was give thanks when he received the answer he was looking for from God, when he received that help. Even when he wrote this book, when he penned this writing, before telling us, the reader, what took place, before telling us what the dream consisted of, and telling us what the interpretation was, and telling us about the great things that happened to Daniel, the person, and his friends, being promoted and being given so much power, the very first thing that he writes before all of that is his prayer of thanksgiving. I think that's significant. That's how we ought to do it too, I think. We need to put thanks right back into our prayers as soon as we are helped and comforted by our Father. Have you ever prayed for wisdom before making an important decision? Has anybody not prayed for wisdom before making an important decision? Maybe that's easier. I can think of several circumstances where I can look back on a situation or a decision that I prayed about, asking for wisdom and asking for understanding to try to make the decision. Not saying, "God, make this decision for me. I'm just going to sit here and see what happens." But I'm going to make this decision. I'm going to make a choice. Please give me wisdom and understanding so that the choice I make is a good one. And I can say honestly that on multiple occasions, things worked out better than they would have if I hadn't prayed that prayer. And I think sometimes we might study a book like Daniel and we might think, well, how lucky Daniel was to be able to get an answer from the Father, to get a miraculous understanding of a dream. Boy, I wish I lived in a time like that. I wish that I lived in a time when God was still that active between himself and his children. But the question I want to leave you with at the end of the chapter 2 is it any less amazing and powerful that you can see evidence of God answering your prayers in your life? Is it any less amazing that we can feel that sense of comfort and we can feel that sense of an answered prayer when we ask for wisdom and understanding? I mean, we still have an active God in our lives. We still have a God who listens and who can make changes, who can reach down into this world and change your circumstances. And to me, that's equally amazing, even though we're not going to write a prophetic book like Daniel did. We still can have a conversation with that same God. Yeah. 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 If you didn't hear the point that was just made, it's that faith is a essential part of that. We can't just ask and say, well, maybe that'll work, maybe that won't. What does it say in the book of James at the end of chapter 1? Verse 5, it's at the beginning of chapter 1. But if any of you lacks wisdom, let him ask of God, who gives to all generously and without reproach, and it will be given to him. But he must ask in faith, without any doubting, for the one who doubts is like the surf of the sea, driven and tossed by the wind. Great point. Any other comments or questions on chapter 2 before we move on to chapter 3? I need to use these handy markers in my Bible so I can quit flipping pages. All right, Daniel chapter 3. We'll just keep going. So Daniel's just given King Nebuchadnezzar a glimpse of the future by interpreting his dream. And we've seen that Nebuchadnezzar, in this previous chapter, at least has the experience to know that he needs to deal somewhat shrewdly with his people, right? He needs to deal, I would say, shrewdly with the wise men and the magicians, because he's been a king long enough to know that sometimes folks tell him what they think he wants to hear. They tell him what they need to tell him so that they can keep their own head on their shoulders. That's the king that we're continuing to study here. And Daniel and his three friends are going to be, really, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are going to be the main characters of this story in chapter 3. But in this chapter, we're going to read of the care that God has for these three faithful servants. And as we study this, I want you all to think about something that's maybe a little uncomfortable to think about. I want you to think about the potential for persecution in your life as a Christian. It's difficult for me, I think, teaching this class to try to transition from chapter 2 to chapter 3 because it's a little bit of an abrupt shift in terms of the concepts that are going on in these stories. But there's a lot going on in the world right now, not in this country specifically, but there's a lot of persecution going on in the world, not just of Christians, but of all different faiths and races. And so as we study this story, I want you to try to contemplate, I'm going to have some other things to say about this, contemplate what persecution would really feel like in America. I think it's hard for us to connect with the characters in this story. At least it's hard for me. I'll quit including you in it. I'll just say it's hard for me to connect with the characters in this story because persecution has never been present in my life to the extent that it's going to happen to these three men. There's different levels of persecution. We could spend the whole class talking about that. But threat of death is what we're talking about today. I'm going to read the first 7 verses real quick. Nebuchadnezzar the king made an image of gold. Let me stop right there. The same king that just had a dream told to him and interpreted to him by the Most High God. Just same guy. Nebuchadnezzar the king made an image of gold, the height of which was 60 cubits and its width 6 cubits, and set it up on the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. Then Nebuchadnezzar the king sent word to assemble the satraps, the prefects, and the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the judges, the magistrates, and all the rulers of the provinces to come to the dedication of the image that Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up. Then the satraps, the prefects, and the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the judges, the magistrates, and all the rulers of the provinces were assembled for the dedication of the image that Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up. And they stood before the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Then the herald loudly proclaimed, "To you the command is given, O peoples, nations, and men of every language, that at the moment you hear the sound of the horn, flute, lyre, trigon, psaltery, bagpipe, and all kinds of music, you are to fall down and worship the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar the king has set up. But whoever does not fall down and worship shall immediately be cast into the midst of a furnace of blazing fire." Therefore, at that time, when all the peoples heard the sound of the horn, flute, lyre, trigon, psaltery, bagpipe, and all kinds of music, all the peoples, nations, and men of every language fell down and worshiped the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up. So, have you ever been commanded to worship a false god? It's not really a rhetorical question, you know. I've been surprised more than once. Nobody has ever... I haven't. Yeah, John?
I've been in a couple of weddings.
Okay.
Where they said the service was part of it, but you had to partake of the Lord's Supper, basically, while you're in the service.
Okay.
And they piled everyone up across the front. They wanted to partake of it.
Okay, so this was a Christian wedding, and they were doing communion as part of the ceremony?
Yes.
Okay, so you were still being asked to participate in a religious ceremony that you weren't comfortable with. Okay. That's a great, great example of same kind of thing.
Even afterwards, several people commented that I didn't get up and do it.
Okay. Was that offensive to people? That you abstained from that? Okay. Have you ever felt that a law of this land or any other land in which you've lived, let's say, forced you to choose whether to obey your government or your God? That's kind of a mouthful of a question. Okay. So, in other words, maybe the money that our tax dollars are being used, some of our tax money is being used for things that we don't...
Well, and companies will provide medical insurance. You've got to pay for this, and then we'll provide health care. Okay. So, it's a
Hobby Lobby, yep, took a stand against that. That's right.
There's some others, too.
Yeah. Nathan? Okay, so if you didn't hear Nathan's comment, he was pointing out that, was this early on during the healthcare issue? Okay. The government's saying, you know, to certain religious organizations, as part of this new healthcare act, you've got to provide contraception to people that want it. Yeah, that was a, there's a whole tangled mess of issues surrounding that for sure. Yeah, one of the big ones for me is just, I try not to look too hard sometimes at what our tax dollars are being spent on. Because I become angry really quickly, and that's not helpful to anybody. But there are definitely some things that pot of money is being spent on that are ungodly. It's not just a matter of whether you agree that the environment is a priority, or that this group of people's special interest is a priority. There are some flat-out ungodly things that the collective pool of money that we all pay into get funded through, right? It's the closest thing I could come up with. Was just curious what you all thought. But you know, I want to put a kind of a different spin on this for a second. Although we aren't necessarily forced a lot of the time, there are a lot of things at our disposal in our society that we can choose to pursue almost to the point of worship. You know, hobbies, pastimes, things that are important to us that really have no significance in any eternal way. We can pursue things to the point that we put so much emotion and so much money and so much energy into it that we're almost invested in it, to the point that some people are invested in their own religion. That's been a stumbling block for me in my life. And I try to make some of these challenges real for us. And that's one way in which I think if we're not careful, even though we're not talking about something that the government is forcing upon us, we can find our own distractions, right? We can find our own idols in our lives if we look hard enough and if we're not careful. I'm going to continue on in verse 8. For this reason, at that time, certain Chaldeans came forward and brought charges against the Jews. They responded and said to Nebuchadnezzar the king, O king, live forever. You, O king, have made a decree that every man who hears the sound of the horn, flute, lyre, trigon, psaltery, and bagpipe, and all kinds of music, is to fall down and worship the golden image. But whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast into the midst of a furnace of blazing fire. There are certain Jews whom you have appointed over the administration of the province of Babylon, namely Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, have disregarded you. They do not serve your gods or worship the golden image which you have set up. Then Nebuchadnezzar, in rage and anger, gave orders to bring Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Then these men were brought before the king. Nebuchadnezzar responded and said to them, Is it true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the golden image that I have set up? Now if you are ready, at the moment you hear the sound of the horn, flute, lyre, trigon, psaltery, and bagpipe, and all kinds of music, to fall down and worship the image that I have made, very well. But if you do not worship, you will immediately be cast into the midst of a furnace of blazing fire. And what God is there who can deliver you out of my hands? So obviously the experience that he had with Daniel interpreting his dream is not enough to make him think that that same God can prevent the death of someone. Now, there's other ways to look at this. There's a question in Daniel, in the whole book of Daniel, as to the chronology that things are happening in. There are some commentaries that might say Daniel 3 is actually taking place prior to Daniel 2. I don't necessarily read it that way. I think that there are some parts of Daniel 2 that probably happen right before the end of chapter 1. And the end of chapter 1 is kind of a wrap-up where Daniel is writing about things that are going to happen to him throughout the rest of his life. Right? He says Daniel served under multiple kings. That's stated at the end of chapter 1. There's a certain amount of time that has to take place for Daniel and his three friends to be admitted as fully developed wise men. That's mentioned at the end of chapter 1. So chapter 1, you know, kind of makes a leap forward and talks about the rest of Daniel's life for just one or two verses. But, you know, I think that we're talking about something that happened after the first dream was interpreted to King Nebuchadnezzar. So he's a complicated guy. He's witnessed the ability of the God of heaven to not only tell him what he dreamed, but also interpret it. But he doesn't believe that that same God that these three men serve can save them, as stated in his own words here. So in verse 16, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego replied to the king, O Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to give you an answer concerning this matter. If it be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the furnace of blazing fire, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But even if he does not, let it be known to you, O king, that we are not going to serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up. So this is the first, but not the last time, that a group of Chaldeans are going to try to stir up some trouble for some faithful Jews.
Because Daniel set them up over the province. So others that want their position
Right.
And so it's kind of like Daniel Lyon's den repeated earlier.
Yeah, I was going to say the same thing. If you didn't hear Alan's point, he was pointing out that these men have other motives. They stand to benefit from the destruction of these three men for political reasons, which is exactly what we see later on in Daniel in the story of the lion's den.
Because if they hadn't brought it to the king's attention, nobody would have noticed.
Right. Probably not. And that's also true of Daniel praying, you know, in his upper room. They had to go seek him out. So do you think, here's a tough question, do you think your faith is strong enough to give the same answer that these three men gave? And think about it this way. There's a knock at your door. It's the government. You open your door, and there is sufficient force present on your doorstep to take you against your will away to execution if you don't deny Jesus Christ and the God of heaven. Do you think you can stand firm? I'm not sure that I can. I'm just going to confess to you openly right now, that thought terrifies me, and I don't know what I would do.
Well, I might be able to do that, but my children's life is great.
Exactly. To take it a step further, what if my children, what if your children, what if your grandchildren were the ones that were being threatened? What do we call it when someone dies for their faith? Martyrdom. I know this isn't a comfortable topic, you know, but I think it would be worth our time to spend a few minutes on it. There are some powerful examples of martyrdom that you can read about. One of my favorites is Polycarp. Polycarp was a disciple of the Apostle John, and he's generally thought to be one of the last surviving men. When he died, it's believed he died in the Roman Colosseum, but it was a Roman stadium for sure. When he died, it's thought that he was the last living man who actually knew the apostles, who learned from one of the apostles. He was famously courageous before his executioners. We don't have really any inspired writings about him, but we do have what we believe is an eyewitness account of his execution. And I've read it in a couple of different forms. There are some modernizations of it where the language is, you know, it's tried to be rewritten so it's easier for us to understand, just like the versions of the New Testament that we have. But it's believed that he was martyred in his mid-80s. He was teaching the gospel. He was a faithful Christian. He had fled to the Roman countryside. He was staying with some friends, according to this eyewitness account. He wasn't really hiding, though. He had just removed himself so that he could go encourage other people. And they came for him. And according to the eyewitness account that I read, Polycarp didn't resist his arresters. He made no struggle. He just said, God's will be done. He even called for food and drink to be given to the soldiers that had come to take him. And he was later burned at the stake in a Roman Colosseum. And one of the things that he's quoted as saying as he faced his executioners was, "You threaten me with fire, which burns for an hour and is then extinguished, but you know nothing of the fire of the coming judgment and eternal punishment reserved for the ungodly. Why are you waiting? Bring on whatever you want." One of the first times I heard Polycarp quoted, the phrase was, "Away with the atheist and let the fires begin." He also said, "86 years have I served him, and he has done me no wrong. How can I blaspheme my king and my savior?" That was his response to repeated demands that he denounce his savior and resist death. Now, that happened a long time ago. It's thought that that happened in the second century, towards the end of his life. But this happens all the time. It happens all the time today in different parts of the world. There was a young lady, 27-year-old mother, named Miriam Ibrahim. I hope I'm pronouncing her name right. I don't know if any of you have heard of Miriam Ibrahim. Her story was first told about 3 years ago. She was a native of Sudan, which is an Islamic nation. And she converted to Christianity, and then she married a Christian, and they began to start a family. And she was pursued by the Sudanese government as a heretic, and an adulterer. Because in that culture, if you marry outside the Islamic faith, you've committed adultery. You can be charged with that crime, which is a capital crime in that country, unlike here. So at the time, she was 8 months pregnant, and she was sentenced to death because she refused in a Sudanese court to denounce her Christian faith. And she ended up giving birth while she was shackled to the floor of a prison. And she and her husband both were quoted at the time as saying that the only thing they could do was pray. And if you want to go look up this woman's story, it's pretty amazing, but she and her husband continued to pray. And awareness was raised all over the globe, and Christians everywhere started to pray. And she was eventually released because the government couldn't stand up to the political and social outcry that was being offered up over this woman's position. She eventually moved to the United States, and she's currently here in exile in the United States with her family. But her quote is, "I'm happy despite the difficult circumstances. What happened, what I faced, was a test of my faith." She's one of thousands of examples that I could pull out and tell you about this morning. But I just wanted to try to make this a little bit more real for us, because sometimes I find it easier to study about Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. I find it easier to contemplate these three men that none of us will ever know in a culture that I can't really relate to, who were threatened with death. And Daniel chose to write their story for us. It's easier for me to study that. But it's really uncomfortable for me to study about Miriam Ibrahim, because that's going on right now. And she's got little babies just like I do. Yeah, John. Yeah. Yeah, it's tragic. And we are very blessed to be Christians in America, because Christians in other countries definitely don't have the same protections and the same freedoms that we do. I hope I didn't bring the tone of the class down too far, but I think what we all need to do is pray about this. I don't pray about Christians in other places enough. I like to pray about my kids and about you, about the people that I see. But there are a lot of Christians, there are a lot of people that have the same faith I do, who are going through unbelievable trials all over the world. And so let's just understand that that's happening, and let's understand that we have a responsibility to pray about it, the same way that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego prayed, the same way that Daniel prayed, and the same way that Miriam and her husband prayed. That's our responsibility as well. Let's see. Got about 10 minutes. I'm going to keep reading in verse 19. When Nebuchadnezzar was filled with wrath and his facial expression was altered toward Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, he answered by giving orders to heat the furnace 7 times more than it was usually heated. 7 times more. There's another one of those numbers. Was he really saying preheat the oven to 7 times hotter than we typically do that? Or is this just a generic number to say make it way worse than normal? Yeah. He commanded certain valiant warriors who were in the army to tie up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in order to cast them into the furnace of blazing fire. Then these men were tied up in their trousers, their coats, their caps, and their other clothes, and were cast into the midst of the furnace of blazing fire. For this reason, because the king's command was urgent and the furnace had been made extremely hot, the flame of the fire slew those men who carried up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. But these three men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell into the midst of the furnace of blazing fire, still tied up. Then Nebuchadnezzar the king was astounded and stood up in haste. He said to his high officials, "Was it not 3 men we cast bound into the midst of the fire?" They replied to the king, "Certainly, O king." He said, "Look, I see 4 men loosed and walking about in the midst of the fire without harm, and the appearance of the 4th is like a son of the gods." Who do you think the 4th person was? Let the conjecture fly. you don't have to answer that. Verse 26 says, "Then Nebuchadnezzar came near to the door of the furnace of blazing fire. He responded and said, 'Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, come out, you servants of the Most High God, and come here.' Then Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came out of the midst of the fire." Sometimes the wording in the translation in these stories just makes me chuckle a little bit. It's like, "Get out here, you God-fearing rascals, you." But obviously, to Nebuchadnezzar, the source of this miracle is obvious, right? This is not his first time being amazed by the power of the Most High God. Would you say it's fair to assume that his previous experience may have influenced how he responds to this situation? Right.
And he has a recognition of events of recent passing. So he had to have some connection in his mind.
Yeah. Verse 27 says, "The satraps, the prefects, the governors, and the king's high officials gathered around and saw, in regard to these men, that the fire had no effect on the bodies of these men, nor was the hair of their head singed, nor were their trousers damaged, nor had the smell of fire even come upon them. Nebuchadnezzar responded and said, 'Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angel and delivered his servants, who put their trust in him, violating the king's command, and yielded up their bodies, so as not to serve or worship any god except their own God. Therefore, I make a decree that any people, nation, or tongue that speaks anything offensive against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be torn limb from limb, and their houses reduced to a rubbish heap, inasmuch as there is no other God who is able to deliver in this way.' Then the king caused Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego to prosper in the province of Babylon." So one application that I see staring us in the face in this chapter is that as God's people, we have to be courageous. There are going to be times when we need to be courageous. And I hope, for your sake and mine, that we never have to be courageous against a fiery furnace, that we never have to be courageous against a government or a person. Maybe just an insane person that is looking to make an example out of a Christian and just happens to cross paths with us. I hope that that never happens. But God obviously uses courageous, faithful people. We can be God's instruments if he finds us to be courageous and faithful. And there's an amazing thing that happens here with King Nebuchadnezzar. We know that his kingdom isn't going to last. We know that God isn't going to allow the kingdom that he's put together to continue, and we know that God isn't going to allow him to be a ruler forever. But he does a 180 here with regard to these men and with regard to their faith in God. Yeah, Donna? Right. If you didn't hear Donna's comment, she's pointing out that there are some critics or scholars that would call into question the validity of these stories and maybe put them in a different category than we would. Instead of prophetic-inspired writings, maybe saying that these are kind of like fairy tales that are told to affect someone's behavior. They were written and told to keep Israelites in captivity from losing their faith.
Well, it's kind of like, I believe, Thomas Jefferson didn't believe the miracle of the living Jesus.
Sure. Yeah, it's an interesting thing to study, and I would encourage you to do it if it's something that you're curious about. Why or why not we might believe that a book like Daniel is true. I believe it's true, like I think all of you do, because of a mixture of the contents in Daniel harmonizing with other things in the Bible, but also because, like I mentioned in the introductory lesson, this book is one of the writings that was found in the Dead Sea Scrolls discovery. So if you're looking for more material evidence, if you're looking for something that you can reason with another person about, consider the fact that this writing was found amidst other manuscripts that have all been dated by the same scientific methods that might date other writings. It doesn't just amount to carbon dating. It's an appraisal of the way the document was written, the kind of paper that it's on, and the location that it was found in. And even critics have to agree that a lot of these writings that were discovered were penned about 1,000 years before Christ. And that actually puts it right around the time that it could have been preserved and saved if Daniel had actually written down what he saw. So in my opinion, it all fits together, right? It's the opinion of people who are a lot smarter than me. I just tend to stand up here and repeat things that smart people have said, you know, and share it with you guys. But yeah, it's a great point. It's something to keep considering and studying for ourselves. Consider this week some ways that you can be courageous for the God of heaven. And consider how your courage and your faithful conduct might influence the thinking of other people. King Nebuchadnezzar went from being hostile towards these men to passing laws that would preserve them and other people like them in his land. Is that likely to happen to us in America on that scale? I don't know. All I know is that I can make a difference in my office. I know that you can make a difference in your neighborhood. And it's the courage and the faith that we have that I think stands the best chance of getting noticed by someone else. We can evangelize just through our actions and through our courage and through our faith. I appreciate your comments and your participation this morning. I hope it wasn't too much lecture. Next week we're going to get into chapter 4 of Daniel. If you could read through that chapter before next Sunday, that'd be great. And just generally think about ways that you can model Daniel in your life. We've talked about Daniel's character. We've talked about how God cares for his own. This story is an amazing example of God's capacity to care for us. And that's another part of, I think, what helps us be faithful, is just the knowledge that God can actually do these things. God has the capacity to answer prayers on a level that might surprise us if we just go to him in prayer and believe, like was said earlier. Any other comments or questions before we wrap up? Thank you all.